The views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
We have main engine start. Four, three, two, one.
It's the Space Show with Dr. David Livingston, broadcasting to seven continents, consistently bringing you quality news and interviews with the best and brightest minds in the new space economy. Here is the founder and host of the Space Show, the man who best articulates the vision of space commercial enterprise, Dr. David Livingston.
And good morning, listeners. Welcome to the very last final end of 2013 Space Show, December 31st, 2013. Great to be here. Let me give you a couple of notes about this particular show with our guest, Tom Olson. This show is being pre-recorded on the 19th of December, given I have a travel schedule for 10 days starting on Christmas and ending in early January. So Tom and I got together and recorded his usual end-of-the-year program. And because the 31st of December is actually a regular Space Show day, this program will air on December 31st. So you can't call in and you can't send in emails. Although once the show is archived, you're certainly welcome to post your comments on the Space Show blog, and I will make sure Tom comes across whatever it is you have to say. Now, a few people knew that I was doing this pre-record this morning, and so they did send in a couple of questions. So I've got about four or five advanced email questions for Tom for his usual Space Show end-of-the-year roundup. So he will get a few questions that I will read online as we get going in our program. Also, if you've been listening to the programs over the past several days, you'll note that I've been playing archive programs going back to when Tom first appeared on the Space Show doing end-of-the-year summary shows, which I believe go back to 2003. So for the most part, I played shows every other year because we didn't have 10 dates to really do this with. We had about five. So you're going to hear the culmination of where we are in 2013. But if you listen to all of the archive programs starting on the 22nd of December, then you will have a pretty good lead up to see what's been happening in the space community, the commercial space community, the new space community, because that's what Tom and I typically talk about when we do our end of the year program. So there are no phone-in numbers for today. There are no email numbers, email addresses for you to use. But do remember that you can access and post questions on the Space Show blog, which is http://thespaceshow.wordpress.com. And we certainly hope that you are able to do that. Do remember also that we're a trademarked and registered program, but we encourage you to download these shows and to share them with people you think might be interested or might benefit from the programs. Very few restrictions. The only caveats are don't do anything commercial with the programs. Don't edit it yourself for YouTube channels or anything like that. And remember, we don't permit written transcripts, even if they're for your own personal use. And the show will be podcast, and we podcast through Gigadial, so you can find it on our podcasting channel, which is not hard to find, and that RSS feed is on the website, both of our newsletters. And if you have any questions about that, you can certainly email me and ask me about that. And do go to our website, which is thespaceshow.com, because you will see our written detailed newsletter there. And the newsletter will go from this coming Monday, which is the 22nd, to January, let's see, I come back on the 4th, so January 6th. And everything in between there will be on that one newsletter that you'll find on our website. The link is in the middle of the Space Show homepage, so it's not difficult to find. And then everything we do on the program is archived, and you can access all of our shows very easily or just listen to them right off of our website. We do have a Space Show store, and even though Christmas will be over with by the time you're hearing this program, check out our store. It's up at the top called Space Show Gear, and you might find some things that are there of interest. Also, we are a 501c3 nonprofit with OneGiantLeapFoundation.org. And since you're going to hear this show on the 31st, there is still time if you can use a tax deduction or want a tax deduction to make a contribution to the Space Show One Giant Leap Foundation. We have PayPal links on the Space Show website as well as the One Giant Leap Foundation website. And if you have any questions, check out OneGiantLeapFoundation.org or please do email me. I will be getting email while I am in New York playing. My holiday trip to New York is a non-space event. I'm going strictly to play, and hopefully the weather will permit, and it won't be too cold, too much snow, too much sludge, and I'll be able to drink big 18-ounce drinks and do a whole bunch of other really cool things, like seeing the planetarium show that Neil deGrasse Tyson has narrated. So that brings me to introducing Tom Olson to you, and for those of you who have listened to many space shows, you know Tom very well. He's a frequent guest on the program. He has been working in space for more than 25 years. He's been a systems engineer, a business systems engineer, an analyst in the communications, aerospace, and publishing sectors. He has worked in investment analysis in an operations capacity in the financial services area in cash and fund management. He is a classic serial entrepreneur. He helped found the Exodus Group as a way to bridge the gap of understanding between entrepreneurial space tech startups and angel VC institutional investors seeking new opportunities. He is on the organizing committee for the Space Investment Summits. He has done the Space Business Plan Competition for the New Space Space Frontier Foundation for ever since I can remember. And he really knows the commercial space, new space, policy, and all the related stuff better probably than anyone I could bring on the show. And in addition, he's a hoot to do an end-of-the-year wrap-up with because he's got a great sense of humor, he's fun, he's wise, and it's always a pleasure to talk to Tom Olson. So welcome to this pre-recorded end-of-the-year program. I think this is the first time we ever did a pre-recorded end-of-the-year program, isn't it?
That is true, David. We've never done this before, which is it's relaxing and challenging at the same time because we have to assume that as of today, which is December 19th, there's going to be no new important news in space happening for the next 12 days.
I was just going to say, what if something earth-shaking happens and everything we do today is outdated?
Yeah, well, the odds are low, you know, but not zero. So we'll just have to wing it as best we can. We'll add a special blog post or something and acknowledge that this has happened. But once again, David, I just wanted to express my gratitude to you and your show and my ability to once again have the last word for the year.
That's right, you do. You get the last word for the year. By the way, listeners, the lead up shows he's done. We've been on the air for 12 years, coming May, so 11 years. So maybe we've been on the air for 12 years and it'll be 13 years, 2001. Anyway, Tom has been doing this since 2003. So we don't have enough space show dates to play all of the end-of-the-year programs. And one of the end-of-the-year programs, he was joined by Walt Anderson, and we talked largely about Walt's pending legal problems and the issues ahead of him. He had not yet, been convicted or agreed to a settlement or however you want to portray that. So what we're doing, because we don't have as many days as Tom has done end-of-the-year programs for us, we're playing basically every other year. And that should give you a really good timeline and workup as to what's been going on in commercial space and new space, which has largely been the focus of our end-of-the-year programs and space advocacy efforts as well. So if you listen to all of them, and I urge that you do, you'll have a really good time capsule of what's been going on in new space and commercial space over the past decade. And I think this is a really cool way to close out 2013. So, Tom, 2013.
Well, in addition, I was going to add to that. You also, if you listen to those shows, you also get to see just probably how wrong I was about future prognostication. So that's the enjoyable bit near the end. If you want to skip ahead.
Well, they won't get to see any of that because this is audio only. But they can hear how bad your predictions were. Can't even talk this morning.
I'm getting to the point where I don't want to make any anymore. But. I no doubt we will.
And by the way, listeners, we're pre-recording this on the 19th of December, so that'll give you a little bit of a time perspective, but I personally don't think much is going to change between now and the 31st. So how do you see 2013? Good year, bad year, indifferent year?
I think it was a great year. I think it was a lot of interesting things went on, so much so that we'll never be able to cover it all in this program. So I just kind of picked some of the highlights that, you know, I thought were, like, wicked cool, both in the new space area and in related areas, and we'll talk a little bit about all those things, plus this year's BPC, plus, a bunch of stuff. What really got me this year, the big event of this year, really wasn't about us. It was the Year of Asia.
Why do you say Year of Asia?
The Year of Asia, because China has been making some great strides. They just the other day landed a lunar rover, only the third country in the world to do that in the last 55 years. This is part of their ongoing long-term program. They want to have a habitat of their own up there by 2015. They're launching another Shenzhou next year early. To again pave the way. Their program has been kind of slow and steady, but given their recent successes, I'm sure there are people in the policy, you know, wonk area, they're probably wetting themselves a little bit. I know the Russians are finally starting to show their concern because they were actually a little derisive at first, even though the Chinese had borrowed a lot of Russian technology and expertise originally when they first started their program. But now they're actually starting to do something with it. And there's a few Russians over there that are saying, hey, wait a minute, you better take a look at these guys or we're going to be left behind. So they're concerned about it. I'm sure some U.S. policy people are concerned about it for their own reasons. I'm not so concerned about it. I've been reading some stuff where everybody, all these policy guys, think that, you know, Asia in space in general is perceived as somehow destabilizing. And my take on that is, hey, get over it. There's plenty of room in space for everybody. As you know, space is virtually infinite. So I don't see why everybody's getting all in a tizzy over this. But it's not just China. South Korea placed its first satellite in orbit this year. Japan launched a new 3-stage rocket, and India is now setting its eyes on Mars. And they just dispatched its first mission to Mars.
But, you know, I think why people are nervous about China is because their space program is under control of the PLA, their military.
Yeah.
So I think that's, an alarm issue for a lot of people, because most of the other space programs that you talked about are civilian and not military.
Well, the alarm bells really are basically ringing because the other space powers right now are a little bit cash strapped, but China is an economic powerhouse right now. That's why they can afford to kind of lead the pack in Asia, at least. But it's not just China. Again, they launched a Shenzhou 10 this year, and they have a 15-day trip, and they already have an orbiting space module that's paving the way for a 60 metric ton permanent space station by the end of 2020, and they want to launch a space lab around 2015. Now, just this last November, India launched a mission to Mars, which is what they call a called Mangalyaan. I'm trying to read this thing. It's a Mars orbiter, though. It's an actual orbiter. It's the size of a small car, and it's supposed to be able to detect methane, which is, you know, a possible life signature. Not completely, but they keep using methane as the life signature. I don't know why.
Yeah, and it gets there about 2 weeks after MAVEN gets there, our mission.
Yeah. And again, I think the China's first moon rover was just launched December 2nd on a Long March rocket. And that's why I think it's interesting they call their rocket the Long March, because that's kind of their attitude towards space development. It is they're in a marathon and not a sprint. They have very grand plans, but they achieve it using incremental steps, in some ways, a lot emulating what New Space does. They've learned from the mistakes of their competitors, and they have this long program. Sprinters like the U.S. and Russia need to take note of this, because they're not going away, and they're not going to be beaten through brute force competitively. You need to, if you want to stay in competition with China, you need to learn to innovate. The U.S. is in actually a good position of that if they just get their collective head together and start looking at alternative launch options like the Falcon 9 Heavy, and we'll get into that.
Of course, we're not going anyplace, so, there's a lot to look at China, and, I did my bachelor segment for Hotel Mars several weeks ago with Dr. Paul Spoudis, and Gordon Chan was one of the hosts a bachelor, and he's Forbes.com in Asia. And, they were all up in arms and talking about China and everything. And, Paul said, the concern is more not about what China's doing, but the fact that we're not doing very much.
Uh-huh.
And that was his perception on that, which I kind of think so too. I think, space is obviously open for everyone. So in a sense, the more the merrier, and you certainly don't want to stop anyone or get in the way of anyone going out and doing things in space. But we need to be doing it too.
Well, he says we're not doing anything, but we're not doing anything, in the public NASA-based sector. The government sector, that's where all the slowdown is. Stuff that's going on in the world of New Space is proceeding at a very brisk pace. And they've had some great successes this year, which we're going to discuss.
Okay. What are some of the successes? Are you ready to get into that?
Oh, sure. Absolutely. Let's go with COTS first. Since COTS has been officially declared over, with the focus now being on commercial crew, for about an $800 million total investment, roughly, they've gotten at least two independent spacecraft from both SpaceX and Orbital that can go to ISS and do resupply missions. Now the focus, again, and SpaceX actually flew one this year. Orbital flew one this year. It demonstrated
success.
They demonstrated Cygnus, which is Latin for swan, by the way. And that was just 3 months ago they did that. They took a couple of metric tons to ISS and did a resupply mission. Now, they were supposed to have a second flight. It was supposed to, go tomorrow, actually. But it's been postponed because they're having some problem with cooling problems on ISS, and they're going to do a series of spacewalks to correct the issue. And so the second Cygnus launch was postponed to sometime in January. And that flight, actually, the Cygnus flight, that was only the second flight of the Antares booster.
It once it got going, because it was late, it's behaving very nicely and performing, right on the money.
And so hopefully they will continue to do so. Then you turn around and look at SpaceX. They've done a second Dragon resupply flight to ISS. They did that in March. We cut back another year about the middle of 2012. They did get $440 million to develop commercial crew. And the whole commercial crew idea, they want to have commercial crew fully developed and funded and operating with at least one provider, if not two providers, by 2017. So there's still they still feel they're on track to get that done. Basics had a huge year. They also demonstrated the Grasshopper. Now, this is a thing. It's a, you know, a takeoff and landing on the pad kind of vehicle, but it's the largest one that's ever been built. It's a fully reusable rocket. It's not like these smaller demonstration flights that we've been doing for the last few years for Centennial Challenges and other things. This thing is taller than a 10-story building. And they demonstrated that they could launch that thing straight up in the air and bring it down again. And also in August, they did something they called a divert test, which is very important because it's one thing to do something just straight up and straight down again. It's another thing to go up a big distance and move somewhere and then move back again and bring the thing down. And that's what they demonstrated in August. They flew up about 250 meters, diverted the vehicle about 100 meters in a lateral direction, and brought it back again and landed, you know, spot on the pad. So I believe their goal there is to actually make an even larger version and use it as a fully functional, reusable first stage for the Falcon program.
Yeah, they're making progress, and they've restarted their engines, and they seem to be, you know, on some schedule for what their goals are.
Yeah, there's also a little bit of controversy attached to that because they've been in the process. There's been this competitive negotiation that everybody, you know, reads about. They're in the process of negotiating a lease for Pad 39A.
And they have to remake it, of course. They were competing against...
They have to remake it, probably, presumably, on their own dime, but it has been maintained a little bit. They spent... There's like a... Right now, even out of NASA's budget, it's like $1.2 million a year for just, you know, maintenance of 39A to keep the rust off, essentially.
Well, they were awarded it.
A lot of refurb they're going to have to do, but other than the other policy suggested a few years back, which was to let it rust in place... They're trying to make some use out of it.
And they competed against Blue Origins, but SpaceX won the competition, as I understand it.
They did, and now they're in final negotiation for a lease agreement. And at the end of that, when that decision was made, Blue Origin actually lodged a protest and cried foul. Because their understanding was they wanted Pad 39A to be used for multiple commercial purposes, and not just by a single provider. And there were some also ideas floated around that 39B could be used for multiple purposes. But right now, NASA has decided to... It's like in football, you know, they do
right.
Further review on the screen and after a controversial play. Well, that's kind of what happened. The refs did further review and decided that SpaceX won the call, and so they're just negotiating now... a final deal with SpaceX for 39A. Whether it becomes of commercial use for multiple providers is remains to be seen.
There is a great video that somebody did recently of a 39A tour going all the way to the top, and it's really good. And I didn't save the URL for it, but people, I guess you could Google for webcam tour of Pad 39A, and you might find it. It's very, very recent. It was done on a clear day, and having been up on 39A, because I have been all the way up, and if you're scared of heights, it's pretty freaky, let me tell you.
Yeah.
This is a great video, and I even got all of my feelings back about heights by watching that damn video, because whoever shot it really captured it really well. It'll be interesting to see what SpaceX does when they go to remodel it, because, you know, the shuttle needs for it were, you know, significantly different than what a Falcon's going to be using it for.
Well, I'm just thrilled that a very important piece of our space history is going to be refurbed and still be in use.
Yeah, and recycled. Future
generations
right.
will be able to enjoy this. And maybe even future generations will launch from it themselves.
I wonder if the revisions will be as high up, because I don't know the height of a Falcon Heavy or a Falcon 9 relative to a shuttle ready to go. But when you go all the way up to the top, they take you up to where you would have gotten into the shuttle if you were an astronaut. So the rocket is still higher on the pad than where you are.
Uh-huh.
And honestly, if you get bothered by heights, it's pretty freaky, especially if it's windy.
Well, how high was that, do you know, off the top?
And I want to think about 300 feet, but I may be wrong.
That's about the same. Because that same pad launched, you know, Saturn V.
Right.
To the moon. That was 363 feet sitting on the pad, tip to tail.
So you could go higher, but they took us to the level where you would get off. We took the elevator up, although there is an exposed stairway. But we took the elevator up, and you get off, and you walk a gangplank over to the white room, which is this little room suspended on the gangplank with like a tent surface around you or something like that. And, you know, that's kind of like the holding place. And then from there you would go into the shuttle. And that's about 300 feet, as I remember. But obviously, you know, the rocket is higher than that. But we didn't go anything higher than where you would go with the white room and enter into the vehicle. And that's shown really well in this video. I wish I had saved the URL so I could put it in the archives and tell people where to go to see it, because it's really a good rendition. But you can see all around. You can see the Atlantic and the area and all of this. And they didn't let us jump in the escape chutes or anything, but, you know, they do have escape chutes that go down and under. And we did go into the room where the escape chutes come out once we got down there. But, you know, if you're scared of heights and you don't like wind blowing at you when you're up high, this is not where you want to spend some time. And if you had to go down the gangway stairs to get down off the platform, you know, there are metal steps with a railing, and, you know, and you see through them all the way to the ground. So, you know, again, if you're somebody who gets bothered by heights, this is not a tour you want to take. I guess the astronauts could care less, because they move around up there, and the workers and the engineers and all that, as if it's nothing.
Right.
You know, like high-rise office builders, you know,
that
can walk all, I mean, amazing people.
But back to the original question, I don't know enough about Falcon 9 Heavy, how tall it is. I'm sure it's not as tall as either the shuttle or Saturn V was, fully loaded, a little more squat formation. But I don't know how much refurb they're going to have to do get up to speed for that. Maybe a lot of the original equipment can just stay in place and just have a little farther to fly to, you know, get past the tower.
Well,
I don't think they're going to chop the tower down.
I don't know enough about it either, and obviously entering a Dragon is different than entering a space shuttle. So, you know, so that's completely different. And the profile, I don't think the Falcon Heavy has external tanks. So, you know, the profile is going to be different on the pad than a shuttle with the external tanks and all of that. There'll be some retrofitting. You know, they'll probably still have the flame pits and stuff like that. I don't think they'll use the rubber room
Similar configuration. It basically is, it's still Falcon Heavy is still three Falcon 9s strapped together linearly.
Yeah, it's a big mother rocket.
To look at the external, you know, solids and just puff them out a little bit so they're a little bit bigger and kind of match the size of the external tank, and that's what you have. So there may not be much refurb they have to do to accommodate that.
It's in much better condition than where... So I saw where they launched the Falcon 9 when they just took it over. I took a tour of that just after they got it from the Air Force, and they had not started to renovate it yet. And Pad 39A... has been preserved in mint condition. It you know, if we had shuttles today, they could put a shuttle there and get it ready for flight, and there wouldn't be a lot that they had to do to the pad, which is unlike where they fly Falcon 9s at in the Cape. They had to really, you know, renovate that entire pad. So this is in really excellent, pristine condition. So what they have to do to retrofit it, I can't tell you. But they are getting it in mint condition, and you know, it's only been, what, 2 years since it was used.
Mm-hmm.
So unlike where they're flying the Falcon 9s, for that pad hadn't been used for a long, long time.
Right.
And they had let it deteriorate. So it's going to be really cool when Falcons launch off of pad 39A. There's no doubt about that. That'll be one hell of a thing to watch. I hope I can go down and see launches in person.
Yeah, that'll be a lot of fun.
Absolutely. And I don't know that I'd want to go back up, but I'm not great at heights. But fortunately, we had the elevator, so we didn't have to walk the metal stairs. But it's if you ever do get a chance to do a Pad 39A tour before SpaceX starts remodeling it, I would really urge listeners to find a way to take that tour and do it, because it's really amazing. You know, when you look at that pad, Tom, and you see all the valves and fittings, you wonder how they even designed the damn thing. And everything has a purpose. I mean, it's not just there for decoration.
Right.
And, I mean, you know, I'd love to see the blueprints of that thing and to see what all this stuff does. But it all has a purpose, and it's all functional, and it is an amazing, complex piece of machinery. I guess that's the only way to describe it. I think it's amazing that anyone could come up and create something like that.
Yeah.
SpaceX has it. That's right. And people, go take the virtual tour if you can find the link on the internet.
Just one more thing. Moving on, just one more thing I want to add in terms of like the private guys who are building vehicles. I want to just touch on Dream Chaser very quickly.
Okay.
Even though they're not a COTS winner, they're not in development in that regard. They still have a deal with Boeing, I guess it is. And they're doing, you know, they've got money from other sources. They're still built, so they're still fully building and getting ready to deploy the Dream Chaser reentry vehicle. They have done a couple of drop tests this year on it. The last one they did was October 26th, and they dropped it, I think, from 3,000 feet or something, and they deployed and floated down and it, right onto a perfect on-target landing on the runway there. But their left landing gear failed to deploy at the final touchdown, and it sustained some damage. Now, they say that the damage is fully repairable, and they're ready to continue their testing. So we'll see how that goes. But there was that little event this year. But otherwise, the development of that craft is very interesting. I think we should keep a close eye on it.
You know, that Dream Chaser is the Space Show listener favorite vehicle.
Really?
I'm sure it's because of the aesthetics and the shape.
Mm-hmm.
Because it is beyond cool. And everybody loves, I've never found anyone who just wasn't like near orgasmic over Dream Chaser. They just love it to all. And a lot of people really don't like capsules. They think it's a throwback for 40 years to Apollo, Mercury, and Gemini, and that we can do better. So the capsule idea doesn't resonate with everybody, but Dream Chaser does.
The problem I have with that assessment is that when we were back in the day when we were building capsules, those capsules were actually going somewhere interesting. Everybody, most of the people, a lot of the people listening to your show are of the shuttle generation, who that's all they've known. But old guys like us know better. We know that last. Yeah, the shuttle spent 30 years going round and round in circles on Earth, and those were years that we spent not going somewhere.
What you mean, like us?
Yeah, like, well, you're older than I am, David.
Hey, don't tell anyone that. I did a show with Juris the other night and Jim Logan, and you know, I made a comment that John is about 2 years older than me, so he didn't give me any flack about it. But
he couldn't. I mean, when we were doing the old Space Cynic blog, he put himself down as Old Space Cadet. That was his handle.
So true, so true.
So what can he say?
Yeah, well, he could change it to Codger Space Cadet, but or Geezer. Anyway, let's go on with the thing. you know, they started running reruns of the $6 Million Man on one of those retro TV cable stations.
Right, and it looks a lot. And that lifting body looks a lot like Dream Chaser, doesn't it?
Absolutely, in the preview.
I had the same idea.
In the run up, yeah, that's the Dream Chaser lifting body. So, which did crash.
yeah, well, with inflation now, if we ever want to build a guy like that again, we're going to call him the $6 Billion Man, I think.
That's true. What do you think the highlight of commercial space, new space, has been for 2013?
Oh, well, we've just spent the last 20 minutes or so discussing them. I think there are multiple highlights.
Well, pick the top one. In your opinion, what deserves the blue ribbon?
Oh, my God. That is really hard to say because they're all really good. I feel like I'm a judge in a competition.
You are a judge in a competition.
Well, the thing that actually impressed me the most this year was, in fact, Grasshopper, because that's going to demonstrate a whole new capability towards commercial launch in the long run. And it's going to bring the price down even more than it already has.
So you rate that the blue ribbon prize?
For as new space tech development, yes. Depending on your topic. So as far as like, and this leads into the next topic, as far as like space science and commercial development, I think, I won't say it's the year of CASIS, but it's awfully close. It's really the year of NanoRacks.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'd almost put NanoRacks on top of CASIS.
Well, yeah. Well, and here's why. They just celebrated recently their 100th deployment. Since 2009, they have deployed 109 payloads to ISS.
Amazing.
Yeah. And they're just getting better all the time. A good friend of mine, Rich Godwin, who runs Zero Gravity Solutions, said there were... They had in the next year or so, there were 18 different flight opportunities for experiments to ISS.
And that's because of NanoRacks.
That's because of NanoRacks and other, and private carriers starting to go up there regularly now. There were 18 different opportunities available to him to run his stuff. And I guess CASIS just, they finally are coming into their own. They actually, selected their first research flight that they're funding earlier this year, which involves protein crystallography. But they were only selected to be because right. Let me back up a step. ISS was not too long ago was finally declared a U.S. national laboratory. And so what happened was they needed someone, NASA, et cetera, needed someone to run it, and that's when CASIS was selected to have the sole responsibility, apparently, essentially, of
managing
maximized use of ISS experiment platform.
Yeah, to manage it.
And to manage everything.
Yeah.
And to accomplish that, they can provide seed money up to $3 million to help fund promising research projects. They have a lot of seasoned professional aerospace teams are on hand to help develop the payloads and do system integration and post-flight data analysis. They work with proven launch providers around the world so they have access to launch for the station or beyond. They have a lot of administrative support. They claim they can help cut through red tape to facilitate a quicker access. And they also do some educational outreach. So they're doing a lot. And they're finally starting to really find their stride in all of this. They've only been around a couple of years.
Yeah, I think 2013, they really came into their own.
They're actually getting some things done, and a lot of people are starting to step up and work with them. And they just co-sponsored a conference back in October that was apparently very successful. To basically, open the door to everybody and let them know they're there.
I told everyone up front that I'd gotten a few email questions. People knew I was doing this pre-record with you. So, I'm going to read one of them. So this is, John sent in a note from Houston, Texas. And he says, Tom, Do you think sequestration hurt or helped the new space and commercial industry during 2013?
Okay. Let's go there. I have something here. I found a website that showed what actually happened, how it affected NASA in particular. And actually, Jeff Faust wrote the article. It was for Space Politics. I think that's his website too.
Right, it is, yeah.
Yeah, okay. But in March, he wrote an article when the sequestration was just starting to happen. And he analyzed the OMB report detailing the amounts of cut. And this is, I got a table in front of me. I'll just go through the highlights. The effects of sequestration on the budget, and that was based on a 5% cut for each NASA account. So the biggest losses were exploration of $332 million loss from there. Space technology, $149 million cut, and construction, $237 million cut. But the total cuts were about just a little over $700 million. It probably affect, of course, given the relative funding levels of different things, those cuts are going to hurt some groups more than others. The science took a hit, but also commercial development, commercial crew and COTS took a hit. And that would hurt them more because they got a lot less money. So a 5% hit on them is really meaningful as opposed to a 5% cut from, say, SLS development. It may have slowed them down a little bit, but it didn't really bring things to a screeching halt. And I wanted to say about that was despite those speed bumps, as I talked about earlier, there were still some lovely successes in the area of COTS and commercial crew development. So, because we still had two successful commercial flights to ISS this year from the two COTS contractors, SpaceX and Orbital Sciences. So yeah, it hurt a little bit, but it didn't hurt enough to be a complete showstopper for anybody. Now we can go round and round as to whether, you know, SLS is a good investment and could those funds be better used elsewhere. But maybe we can get into that near the end.
Well, I do see that Congress is trying to maybe the legislation even passed, I don't know, to not ever be able to cut or terminate SLS.
Well, that's the only way they could keep SLS funded, I guess, is by force of arms.
Absolutely. God forbid they should actually try to fly the damn thing and use it for real missions so that
we've probably spoken of this on previous shows, but let me remind everybody just as a comparison. SLS was developed kind of on top of the ruins of the old Constellation program that was chartered under the Bush administration. They spent about $8 billion and didn't have a lot to show for it at the end of all that, except they still have the Orion capsules under development. That was a holdup. That was a leftover that carried forward. But the total, by comparison, the total development cost of up through Falcon 9 and the Dragon capsule was about a tenth that, about $800 million total. And look at their successes versus, you know, the profound lack of success after spending $8 billion in Constellation. Well, not a lot of people expect great things from SLS by comparison. I'm willing to be surprised, but I would be shocked if that thing ever actually was completed and actually launched something. Because one of our other friends, John Strickland, wrote a paper a few months back, published a paper doing a detailed analysis on what the total, you know, real world expense of SLS would be, depending on realistic launch rate, flight rate. And the amounts were staggering, and it raised the question out of what kind of bang for the buck will you get from SLS?
Well, not much if you don't fly it very often. Once in, what, 4 years?
Yeah, something like that, or once a year, or some, a year flight rate. It just doesn't pay for itself in any way. It's just a huge budget buster. And what are we getting for that?
Maybe they'll open it up in between flights to museum tours.
Well, that's the thing, is that that's what just and really upsets me about all this, is they're spending all that money for this thing. It'll probably fly once, if it flies at all. But then you could lift the same payload to the same distance on two Falcon 9 heavies and do one piece of on-orbit assembly, and you're done for a fraction of the cost.
Well, keep in mind that the massive SLS payload capability is delayed for a decade.
Yeah.
So the one coming out in 2017, 18, 19, is just marginally larger than Falcon Heavy. I think it's, 70 tons?
Yeah.
And Falcon Heavy's around 50 tons.
Right.
So.
And again, if everything's on schedule, commercial crew will already be happening by 2017. And while they're still lumbering out there to the pad with their maybe once only SLS launch, there will probably already been at least one, if not two, successful crew transfers to ISS on a Dragon or a Cygnus.
Well,
which will make them look silly yet again.
It appears to have congressional protection. So my hunch is it'll get built. And after that, I guess it's an open book as to what happens with it.
Well, yeah, this whole program, it wasn't built to succeed. It was built to get funded.
A lot of half my audience thinks it should be built and put into operation. It's a placeholder for the workforce for better days, which are sure to come ahead.
But the point of that is, from an economic equation, the better days will never come unless all that knowledge and workforce is redeployed in more economically efficient activities.
That's not part of their understanding of better days.
Well, that's not. Well, that's because they show no understanding of economics. But hey.
I say,
it's not my money, but yeah, wait a minute, it is my money.
Well, indirectly, it's ours. It's coming from taxpayers,
yep,
willingly or unwillingly. So let me ask you, people like to say, what's the best project of 2013? What do you think was the biggest bust of 2013?
With minimum amount of time I've had to research this year,
uh-huh,
I didn't spend a lot of time looking at heroic failures. I just wanted to talk about the positive stuff. So maybe if you have an idea or whatever.
No, I'm trying to. No, I'm really trying to think what would be, the biggest bust of 2013, and I really don't know what that might be.
Yeah, exactly. I don't know what it would be either. I've seen successes from modest to huge.
I mean,
I haven't seen an absolute, auger in the ground, complete utter failure. But then, we always talk about, new space startups and things like that. I mean, there's always out there a bunch of people with some, half-crazed ideas.
Well, if I had to look at I had to rate ideas as to ideas that I think are lousy or not going to fly, I'm really not a fan of NASA's redirect to, bring an asteroid and orbit it around the moon. So that doesn't do anything for me. So I'd probably rate that really high on the absurd side. I'd much rather see other things done by the space agency.
Yeah, if it's, I guess if they're trying to demonstrate some kind of capability, perhaps, but you're also playing a dangerous game moving celestial bodies around and trying to change the Earth orbit landscape.
There's got to be some unintended consequences there.
Oh, yeah. Well, the biggest unintended consequence is, the destruction of all life on Earth. But, hey. It's a risk.
Maybe that's a good thing.
Depends on where that asteroid augers in, whether it's on land or in the ocean.
That's right. What do you think the brightest thing for 2013 was in the new space, commercial space arena?
Again, there are multiple things. We're better commercializing the ISS. NanoRacks has been a huge success. All the great flights have gone on this year, and even Dream Chaser was damaged in a test flight, but they still have a testing program. So we're going to have a lot of commercial capsules and space planes to choose from in the coming years. That's great. Also, a lot of other interesting things I think we should talk about that made the news. I can't really predict how well they'll succeed,
okay. But
we should talk about that. One of them is Inspiration Mars, which was announced earlier this year. A group mostly based out of Europe.
No, this is Dennis Tito.
Oh, no, this is Dennis Tito. I'm talking about Mars One.
Okay.
I'll get to that. Inspiration Mars, yeah, as Dennis Tito's project, their nonprofit foundation, what they want to do is build a spacecraft and fly and do a flyby, basically a pre-return trajectory around Mars, fly a married couple out there and back, and their goal date is January 5th of 2018, because that's a window where the two planets are literally aligned. And we only have that kind of a free return trajectory opportunity a couple of times every 15 years or so. And so the mission is only 501 days long from beginning to end. Now, Tito is going to bankroll some of this, but he doesn't want to be the total stakeholder himself. So they're still out there looking for other opportunities, including, you know, some kind of strategic partnership with NASA and maybe other private foundation funds and larger corporations and things like that. Very inspiring concept, no pun intended. The challenge is, though, we're just a hair over 4 years away from that first launch window. Can they get it done in that short a time is the question. Because the next opportunity isn't until 2031.
Well, I don't think NASA's going to fund them $700 million, which would probably turn out to be $2 billion by the time NASA got through with it. And I don't think they'll make their launch window, so I remain skeptical. But I'd love to see them give it a try. I also don't think the crew will survive, but, you know, it's their choice if they want to do it.
Why do you think they won't survive? Because
I think the human factors, the radiation issues are beyond our capability right now to solve, and I just don't think they will make it. However they equip their capsule and whatever they do, I just don't think it can handle the job. And so if they were able to make their launch window, and I'm skeptical that they can make their launch window, my hunch is that they're not going to survive the trip. But I know a lot of people think they will survive it, and the only way to know, I guess, if somebody really wants to try it. I'm certainly all for people trying it if they want to try it, as long as they're adequately disclosed and they know what the risks are. So I'm very supportive of them giving it a try. I hope they don't have any federal money in it, because I think if you really are getting federal money in it, that you'll never make the launch window. Because they'll tie you up with federal bureaucracy and NASA this and that and all sorts of stuff. And I just don't think they'll be able to get through it all in time to make their window.
Yeah, that could be the case. I guess it depends on how the thing is structured. Getting direct support, that's one thing. Under, say, a Space Act agreement, that would be a little easier. But it depends on if they're providing, you know, a key technology or key expertise in certain areas. That could be useful. My concern is, even if they get out there and make it back safe and not too unhealthy, will their marriage survive 501 days enclosed in a cramped capsule?
Well, if one of the crew members turns up dead, they'll need to do an autopsy to see if they died of natural causes or murder. because the body's coming back, because it'd be really hard to dump it, given that there's no airlock.
Yeah, there are. Yeah, but there are no. There's no such thing as a perfect married couple. They're going to have spats along the way, and there's no escape.
Well, you can go into the other part of the module, I guess.
Yeah.
Right.
So it could be they're just living at opposite ends of the module for the last 200 days or something.
I don't know, but I think it would be tough. I mean, they're talking about a couple of modules put together or something. But look, they want to use SLS as their launch vehicle, and that means that the demo flights for SLS to test it out would have to be committed to Inspiration Mars, because SLS is only supposed to be starting to be tested around 2017-2018, and tested without people on board. So if they did find a way to corral SLS as their launch vehicle of choice, then all those test flights are going to be human test flights. I just don't see it happening.
Well, we've done that before. We have a heritage of that.
Oh, yeah. A lot of the early Apollo missions. Yeah, 50 years ago.
The first shuttle flight was considered an all-up test.
Yeah, but this is 2013. It's a different world.
Yeah.
And Congress is a different makeup. And I personally don't see it happening.
Yeah.
But I don't even know that SLS would be operational. Look, they got this bill in Congress to not be able to cancel it, but that doesn't mean they'll build it to the point where it'll fly.
Yeah.
So God knows the status of SLS come Christmas to January 5th, 2017 to 2018. It's got like a 5 or 6 day, launch window in there.
Right, right.
So I'd love to see them give it a try, and I think it'd be really, really cool to see it happen, and hopefully they could return and not bounce off the atmosphere at the speeds they're going to be coming back in. But I guess if they don't make it and they bounce off the atmosphere, that's a hell of a burial ground. So,
yeah, they'll be. But it also offers an opportunity, if they can pull it off, of testing a lot of other interesting things. I know there's at least two companies out there that are developing, for use on Earth mostly, internal biotech radiation mitigation damage solutions. So it may be that while they're out there, you're saying they'll be exposed to radiation. They may be able to once a month do an IV of this stuff, and that helps protect them internally against some of the damage. I don't know.
I don't know either. I don't know, but it'd be fun. What are your Mars One got enormous publicity during 2013.
That was a great, interesting thing. I mean, they've got this thing. They just want to send people on a one-way trip to Mars. They want to start launching them in 2023. They're going to do a first. They want to do a first test flight again in 2018. Another 2018 launch window. They want to do an unmanned test flight and to test out key technologies, and they're serious. But this first test launch, you're actually using crowdfunding to try to fund it.
Are you optimistic?
It's a very populist type of endeavor, because they had over 100,000 people actually made an application.
200,000.
It's a 200,000 now. They paid $20 a pop for that.
They raised
$4 million just on the publicity. I'm sure that helps a lot.
Absolutely.
Great deal if you can get it, said an embittered Bob Zubrin. But
did you send in a video application?
I did not. And I'm glad you asked that question, because I'll tell you why. I actually had lunch with Baz Lansdorp, the head of this operation.
Yeah, he's been on the space show twice.
Yeah, I had lunch with him at ISDC last May.
Uh-huh.
And he essentially said to everybody at the table that over 55 need not apply.
Well, so he's discriminating against geezers.
That's right.
But geezers are more resistant to radiation.
Absolutely. I don't know what he's thinking. And by the time the first cruise got launched, I would still be technically under 70.
But he also, geezers will be losing cognitive abilities. So also geezers would be harder to establish a pregnancy, especially if the women were geezers too. So you wouldn't have the risk of a fetus in that environment, which could be a disaster.
Here's the thing. I wanted to apply for the position of village elder. I thought that would be a great position for me.
What does village elder do on that mission?
Well, I guess once you've landed and are established, you have your community started, you need a village elder to provide wisdom to the tribe. You know, that's what you're doing. You're establishing a tribe.
So no one over 55 can apply.
Well, he said, don't bother because you're not going to be considered.
How rude. That's age discrimination.
Yeah, pretty much. Because I still have this idea that, yeah, someday I'm going to be 170 years old because of nanotechnology. And I'll be going to Mars myself on a spaceship I built myself from spare parts. So if he doesn't have that kind of vision and I do, what's that say?
I'd just say you're both
crazy. One of us is crazy. Let's put it that way.
I think you're both crazy. But I don't believe. I'm skeptical about Mars 1, too. I don't think they'll ever launch.
Yeah, well.
I don't think they'll raise enough money.
Well, that's it. It's all about money. In the end, it's all about money.
How much
did they raise and what do they do with it and how effectively?
And I don't think they're really going to be able to handle the technology and all that's needed. And, you know, they have to find out where you can put humans on Mars by that, I forget, the Planetary Protection Office or whatever it's called.
Mm-hmm.
You can't just go anywhere. Like, if you want to go look at the face on Mars, you may not be allowed to go there. So I think it's a real far-fetched idea, and I don't know, I just can't see it happening, and I'm not surprised that 200,000 people around the world and more would like to get off of Earth and go live someplace else.
Yeah.
That doesn't surprise me at all.
Uh-huh.
I kind of wish we were in a time where some of this stuff was really plausible and doable and almost routine, but not quite routine. But I just don't think we're there yet. So maybe Boss will prove the skeptics wrong. We'll see.
Well, again, it's just a matter of how much risk are you willing to take. And it's, as you said, we're a lot more risk-averse in our culture today than we have been at any time in our history. And yet there's still a handful of people trying to stem the tide and then push the envelope a little bit. I mean, this goes back to the early days of seafaring. In the 16th century, when Magellan and his ships did a round-the-world voyage, 90% of the crew didn't make it, including Magellan himself. But enough people were willing to take the risk and sign on and jump on board and have a great adventure.
You know, if I had a chance and it were plausible and reasonable to think that you would survive it in good chance and money was not an object, and I could do a tour of Mars and come back...
Uh-huh.
I'd be pretty keen on doing something like that if I, you know, could tolerate all of what you have to tolerate to do it. But I don't have any desire to do a one-way trip and never come back. But if I had a chance to legitimately visit Mars and be a tourist, I would jump at it if mm-hmm. I could do it. Absolutely.
You're probably going to have to wait another 50, 60 years for something like that.
Well, I'll be reincarnated by then, and I may not care about space.
Well, you know, but one-way trips are actually a very, you know, they've argued about that for years as a more cost-effective way to get a foothold on Mars or someplace else.
Oh, I know. And then
you don't expect to come back. Just like when you jumped on the ship to come to the New World, you weren't expected to come back.
And, you know, if all goes well, they'll blaze the trail for future generations. And so hopefully it works. But I guess for 2013, if I were going to talk about Mars One, I would say the accomplishment for Mars One has to do with the amazing amount of positive publicity the effort has garnered.
Absolutely.
They're amazing with how much news footage and coverage they have. And almost all of it is really positive.
Yeah. So there's a lot of people out there that are really pushing for them to succeed. But, yeah, again, but as we've said here, even if they do succeed beyond our wildest imagination, actually start planting people on the Martian surface in 2023, the question still remains, for survival as a community, are we planting a Jamestown or a Roanoke?
And are we as taxpayers going to have to step up and fund them somehow for resupply or whatever?
And yeah. It's not a direct comparison to the early age of colonization and exploration in like the 16th century, for example. I mean, those projects were funded directly by monarchs.
You know, we never
and people didn't have a say.
We skipped our break, and in theory, this show is supposed to end in 20 minutes or so. Let's take a pause, and can you stay a little later?
Absolutely.
Okay, I don't have a whole lot of time later, but let's take a pause, and we'll take it to 15 or 20 minutes later than planned. So, listeners, stick where you are, and Tom and I will be back in 3 minutes. Don't go anywhere.
The Space Show thanks its listeners for their generous support. The Space Show now joins forces with the One Giant Leap Foundation to further advance space education and the establishment of a spacefaring society and culture in America and the world. One Giant Leap Foundation is a tax-exempt organization with the purpose of advancing space education and development along with The Space Show. Your support of The Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation helps get the word out as to why space is so essential and important to us all. So join with us by going to www.thespaceshow.com and clicking on the Support The Space Show button. Your contribution will help The Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation in continuing its work and bringing you the programming you want free of charge on a continued basis. And remember, your gift to the Space Show is tax deductible.
I'm Dr. David Livingston, creator and host of The Space Show, and I would like to share my vision with you for not only this radio program, but for space development. Space should be like any other place we choose to visit, work in, or call our home. It should be just another destination, like Tahiti, Hawaii, or any place available to us right now on Earth. When this vision becomes reality, we will be spacefaring in our culture, our economy, our society, and in our lives. Our world will be vastly improved by countless space-related benefits, transforming our lives both in space and right here on Earth. And the Space Show is helping to make this vision a global reality. Welcome back, everybody. This is a pre-recorded program, so you cannot call us or send us a live email, but you can, of course, post comments and questions for Tom Olson on the Space Show blog. We're recording this on December 19th, and it will air for the first time on December 31st, the last show for 2013. And our guest, Tom Olson, is with us. It's a year in review. Tom, how do you see 2013 for space advocacy of all kinds?
Good question. I'm not sure what kind of successes there have been. There's no major legislative coups in the offing that you can point to and say, yes, space advocacy got that done. So it's just business as usual, kind of just keeping the pressure on, for certain things. As usual, my favorite group, of course, is still the Space Frontier Foundation, where I'm an advocate and a member of the board of directors. So, full transparency there. We've been retooling a little bit because we've actually met certain goals, and now we're saying, okay, how do we get ahead of the curve next? And we're still working on that because the group was founded to first change the conversation about space and space development. It's always been about development to enable the frontier to happen so people can go out to space and live permanently. That's always what distinguishes this group from other space advocacy groups. We succeeded years ago in changing the conversation about space. So the next thing to stay ahead of the curve was to promote new space. And we kind of coined that term as well, and that's caught on. And now that new space is starting to get successful with a lot of successful companies coming up the pipeline, what's next? And I think what's going to be happening next is we're going to really start pushing now the settlement part of it. Is that's got to be, for anything we do policy-wise or anything else, our attitude is going to be, does this policy, program, whatever expense, help do something to promote space, long-term space settlement?
Do you care where the settlement is?
No.
So it could be in LEO, it could be on the moon.
It could be on the moon, it could be anywhere.
It could be anywhere.
Yeah. Yeah.
So are we going to see that change and action on that starting in 2014?
I think we are. Of course, initiating those conversations is different from getting results from them. It took, the last couple of things we worked on, it took several years to get results. So we'll see where we are. Ask me again in 2020.
That's a long time away, Tom.
Well, it was a long time away for the other things. I mean, the foundation is 25 years old this year. It took them until 2000 to change the conversation, and then since then we've been focused on helping with, develop new space, and now we're declaring victory on that this year.
Do you think space advocacy in general has been taken more seriously by NASA and Congress this year? Do you think it's getting more credibility?
By NASA, yes. By Congress, I really don't know. Because Congress, holds the purse strings, and they still agree to fund SLS to the end for forever. And so it makes you wonder, despite the glaring fact that there's been all these new space successes on a very low budget right in front of their noses, because their salaries and their position in their electoral districts depend on them not understanding that.
Well,
so we still have a long ways to go, as far as Congress is concerned.
Is there any new space advocacy programming that you're aware of that is focused on outreach to Congress?
Not so much that I know of or that I'm really, in tune with. There've always been legislative outreach groups. Sometimes the groups get together. They used to do March Storm for a long time. You remember that?
Right.
I don't know if that's still happening anymore.
Well, I know groups take their membership to lobby for space and at the state legislatures as well as the National Congress. I know that still happens.
That's a big effort. Yeah. There are big efforts going on in individual states like Texas and Florida in particular. And to a lesser extent, and in California, places that have been key space states in the past, and they're starting. In fact, they just built this new facility. I know they built a new commercial development and testing, facility in Texas this last year or two. And X-Corps moved down there and some other companies.
Here, well, that gives me a good question to ask you for 2013. It's actually one of those four or five advanced emails I got from people. So this is Alan in San Diego who knew that you were going to do this pre-record show. And he says, how do you assess the year 2013 for making progress on suborbital vehicles and space tourism?
Well, okay. That's interesting because right now the group that's the most visible, of course, is still Virgin. And they've had some modest successes. They've been doing, they're now doing powered test flights with Spaceship Two. And the latest one was on September 6th. And they got all the way up to they didn't go very high. They only went up to 69,000 feet because they only had a partially fueled engine. But, there were human beings on board. This wasn't an unmanned test flight. So they're feeling their way on this thing and really trying to wring the thing out. X-Corps still doing a testing program of some kind. I'm not skeptical of them. I support them in what they do, but I want to see something from them. Have you seen a Lynx flying?
I haven't even seen a Lynx vehicle, except a mock-up at a conference or something.
Exactly.
Like that.
They have the big mock-up at their facility that they show everybody. And I've seen some pictures from the, the facility where they're actually building the thing. But I'm kind of waiting to see when they're actually going to start test flying this thing, because they're trying to sell a lot of advanced tickets. They're doing all these promotional campaigns, like with Axe and things like that. They claim they're giving away a lot of seats for different private programs like Citizens in Space, but they haven't delivered yet, and so I am hopeful that they will start doing that next year.
Blue, do you know very much about Blue?
Nobody knows much about Blue. That's deliberate.
Yeah, no, I know that. They're really tightly sealed, but I thought maybe you would have some insights.
Not a lot. It's really hard to get info about what's going on in there, and so I'll work at it for a while, and if I just keep hitting brick walls, I just, go on to the next thing. But let me give you possibly a bombshell, though. I mean, I've got some insider stuff going on, and what I've been hearing through the grapevine is that Virgin is considering placing an order for a second Spaceship 2 to be built. Maybe based on, modifications, based on the test data from the testing program that they're doing. Now, that raises that, which is fine. They're going to need more than one if they're going to go fully commercial and actually start flying paying passengers soon. They would need that anyway. But it also raises an interesting question that a couple people I've talked to have also raised, which is the real plan to test the first model completely to destruction?
I have heard from doing the space show for all these years that Virgin was the only company that wanted to have two operating test vehicles in case one of them bit the dust, and then they'd still have another one that they could work with. As far as I know, they're the only one of these companies that at least I have heard over the years had a goal of having more than one test vehicle in case of a catastrophic accident. So it may be that they're now in a position to produce that second vehicle.
That could be true, or even frankly.
I don't know. I mean,
but I know because when we spoke on this topic a year ago, they were still having engine troubles.
And they now there's information that says that all of that's true, and they are going to change out the engines.
Yeah, but the fact that they're actually doing powered test flights with people on board at least suggests that some of those problems are starting to get resolved, and they're feeling more confident. So
maybe they'll test it to destruction with certain people on board. I
can suggest a few.
I was
going to
say I can
go public with that.
I can submit a list.
Yeah.
People know my sarcasm. I'd probably start with members of Congress, but
yeah,
that wouldn't fly. So do you think 2014 will be the year of actual space tourist flights?
I've been saying that for a couple of years now, and I got caught in my own trap regarding that 2 years away joke.
Oh, yeah, that's still
And I guess I was kind of wrong about that, so I'm hesitant now to even talk about it. But actually then, in the long term, I was right about some things, because when we spoke on this like a decade ago, I thought sure that after Spaceship One won the XPRIZE, that the flakiness factor would go away. That finally there's somebody out here who showed the world how it's done, and so a lot of the fruits and nuts bringing out their smoke and mirrors and Kool-Aid would kind of just drift off into the sunset, and we start getting more realistic proposals in the pipeline going forward. Boy, was I wrong. In the next couple of years, there was, the crazies were out there more than ever, sensing I own blood in the water. I don't know. But then over the long term, the last almost decade now, so it's 11 years, it's 9 years plus, that factor has actually started decreasing slowly. The giggle factor has decreased slowly, but it is measurable. I'm seeing a lot less crazy stuff out there than I used to, and things are actually looking more realistic showing of that is clearer than the success of the new space business plan competition.
Before you get to that, 2013 saw some European space tourism vehicles come up on the horizon. I've talked about several of them on the show. There's one in Switzerland. There's a 45-seat plane. I can't think of the name of the company, but I've had them on the show and talked about it in England, and they want to, when they get fully operational, go to a 90-seat version. So have you paid any attention to the foreign carriers for space tourism?
Very little. Not because I don't believe they're possible. I'll tell you why. I mean, I go to these international conferences a lot, and I talk to my investor buddies there and business development guys there, and they all kind of agree that it's they don't have the entrepreneurial culture over there the way America does still. And so it's much harder to get attention and attract capital. I mean, they're getting better at it, but it's a really hard go. They're way behind the U.S. in that capability. So then when somebody comes out with something like a 90-seat vehicle, it's like, well, good luck. You're not going to get a lot of interest from the investor community over there based on something like that. And it'd be only slightly better interest over here.
So you're not looking for 2014 to be a big year for the foreign space tourism vehicles?
No, they haven't shown us anything yet, and I've been going to these events since 2008. And a lot of it still centers around what the ESA is doing. So in terms of entrepreneurial development, things like that, they're at least a decade behind what we've done here.
Okay.
I'll believe it when I see it. And a 45-seat vehicle is not a great example of an incremental steps approach.
Somebody sent me their plans yesterday to review. I won't use the name. And they are developing a 300-person lunar colony. And, you know, I don't think 300 people is a plausible lunar colony given our technology and everything else that we have. So I think it's kind of similar.
And we've had similar announcements over here, just like last year. We talked about Golden Spike.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, I haven't heard much from them this year.
Well, I guess they're raising money and looking for developing their technology.
Well, they have some solid people on the team. I just don't know, you know, what their realistic assessment is of what they're going to do.
But that's an interesting point. We heard a lot in 2012 and not very much in 2013 from some of these ventures. What about Shackleton?
Shackleton, I have frequent conversations with Jim Caravella. We attend all the same events.
Right.
So, that guy is just a powerhouse. He just keeps pushing forward and pushing forward and seeking new relationships and trying to make things happen. So he is absolutely determined to succeed. I can't tell you how well he's done in terms of actual fundraising and getting certain milestones achieved, but he's out there pitching constantly, and he's a very determined guy and very capable guy. So I think sooner or later, with that kind of persistence, something good is going to happen.
Have your ears to the ground on the asteroid mining ventures? And what do you hear about that? There's two of them, right?
Yeah, there are two. I know one of them is having some trouble raising money. The other one...
Which one is having trouble raising money?
The one that started out with none.
So that's Deep Space Industries?
Deep Space Industries. They're having some issues in that regard. But I think if they can continue to team build a little bit, maybe they can attract some initial capital. They're trying to bootstrap. The other guys don't have to bootstrap as much. They have access to
planetary resources.
They have access to some deep pockets, but they're not using them to the extent they could. So technically, they're trying to bootstrap too, but they have a couple of deep pockets as a backup plan.
Okay.
And that's about all I've heard about them this year. I heard another interesting idea from a guy that I don't want to mention his name now, but we can talk about it offline. But he also had a very interesting concept. He sketched it out on a bunch of cocktail napkins at New Space this summer, and I was so fascinated. I hung on to the drawings and made some new sketches, and I've been kind of writing it up a little bit. So we'll see if
what's the idea?
idea. It's about basically you're launching a small vehicle, kind of a legacy vehicle, actually. It's based on a Soyuz, but it has a module with some specialized equipment on it, and you can go in and actually you find the right size nickel iron asteroid, and you're literally, you know, melt the thing from the inside out and extract the stuff you need, and then bring that stuff back. And this comes back in one big lump as, like, almost pure nickel iron or whatever it is you're looking for. You can just soft land this whole thing in one lump on Earth.
But you have always been a promoter of the folly of the trillion-dollar asteroid.
This is not a trillion-dollar asteroid. This is a very tiny little space rock that may have some great stuff on it. And then, but they're going to pre-process a lot of this material on site. And just using automated tools, and then just bring back this lump of stuff that they can sell for a specific price on the global metals market. So it's an interesting concept. I'm trying to, like, get some people to help me look into it a little bit further. I just found the whole thing kind of fascinating. See if it's actually workable. It's not a trillion-dollar asteroid by any means. It's not. It's probably not even a billion-dollar windfall at the end, but it would be enough to keep encouraging them to keep doing it. It's an interesting concept.
One of the other emails that I got is from Sondra, S-O-N-D-R-A, in mm-hmm. Seattle. So Sondra says, Tom, what is your assessment of how changes impacted the regulatory environment in 2013 for space? And what is your assessment of what will unfold with regulations in 2014?
As of right now, the regulatory environment has been unchanged. I mean, AST still runs the show, of course, for commercial entrepreneurship and test flights. As far as I know, that regime is not going to undergo any significant changes in next year. There's supposed to be, I think that the bill establishing all this, all that regulatory environment passed in, what was it, 2005, right?
And then it got extended so it goes for another 3 years or something.
Yeah,
like that.
Okay. So, yeah, because the original bill is like, okay, we'll take another look at it in 10 years. Now you're right, they've extended it another three. So we've still got until about, actually, 2018.
Something like that, yeah.
Before there's going to be any significant assessment of the effectiveness of the current regulatory environment, whether it's going too fast or slowing things down. Hopefully there won't be any tragic accidents between now and then to cause a more serious rethink in that regard. I think we have the right policy right now to do the right things, and it encourages, and the whole point of it is to encourage commercial space development while still protecting what we call the uninvolved public. So we're not creating any dangerous situations, you know, and flight paths for the rest of the public out there who, A, aren't paying the bills, actually, and B, are not interested in space. And that's the way that was set up to begin with. We're going to have a happy balance between all that. And hopefully that balance will be sustained for a few more years. But I don't foresee any major changes of any kind in the coming year. No, not at all.
Okay. Our listener will thank you for that when she hears the show. What are your thoughts on the ability for the new space companies, the entrepreneurs, to raise capital? So they did okay in 2013, you know, with crowdsource funding and as well as venture capital. I mean, Skybox got almost $100 million. How do you see capital acquisition for 2014?
Well, there's a lot of changes in the wind there because because right now, like on Wall Street these days, unless you're doing a capital funding round of $50 million or more, they won't even answer your phone call. So for the bootstrap, out-of-the-garage startup kind of company that we're used to, that only mean a few million to get going. It's been tough going. But what's the game changer, I hate to use that term, but the game changer happening in the last couple of years has been the passage of the Jobs Act. And anybody who's honest will tell you the Jobs Act was passed to curtail some of the abuses that were created by Sarbanes-Oxley. Because of Sarbanes-Oxley's regulatory excesses, IPOs virtually plummeted to almost nothing after it was passed. And the Jobs Act is actually creates Starbucks exceptions to startup companies when they're trying to raise money. And so what and other some sorts of third-party funding operations have sprung up because of the Jobs Act. A group that I work with on a regular basis, again, full transparency, is a outfit called Livingston Securities.
Livingston Securities?
Livingston Securities. I mean, I don't think he's a relation. His name is Scott Livingston.
No, where is this located?
They're based in New York. And they have a series. It's almost like it's not an angel investment group, but it is an investment group. He's got about 2,700 people on board. You don't have to be an accredited investor to get involved in this the way it's structured. But they essentially do IPOs for startup companies. And through the Jobs Act. And they use that regulatory environment to advantage. And a lot of interesting companies, a lot of it's in the bio and nanotech sector, have sprung up and have gotten some serious funding because of these guys. And they also get involved then in the secondary round when these companies succeed. And I think that's where he makes his money, is in the secondary round. But I know Zero-G has been involved with them. I've been involved with them through a startup I'm working with called Convergence. They're also, though, very interested now in the new space sector because of their association with me. I've been talking it up. They've been doing some due diligence of their own. They sent one of their guys to participate on a panel, a funding and capital structuring panel that went on at the New Space Conference this last July. So they're serious about it. I'm still trying to get Scott to be a judge for the New Space Business Plan Competition. I think maybe next year his schedule will permit. But the people like this are now interested in this sector.
Think he would come on the space show and talk about his interest in these areas?
I am sure I could convince him to do that.
Will you
go
for that and introduce me to him? We're not related, but that'd be a fascinating show.
Yeah, I think, yeah. And he's a great guy. He's a great speaker.
And
in fact, I was just out in New York about a week or so ago. There was the third annual, or 10th, maybe it's the 9th annual, I don't know, 10th, Livingston Nano and Biotechnology Investors Conference. We didn't talk about space much, but during the network sessions, he kept introducing me as one of the key guys, in the new space sector, and you should talk to him. So I had some interesting conversations as a result of that.
If he comes on and you want to co-host a show with me, we can do that.
I'd be thrilled.
All right. Let's set it up for next year or January, right, whenever you can do it.
Yeah. That would be fun.
Okay. What else should we cover for 2013? Because we're coming close to when we need to end our little discussion, but
okay.
What else was monumental, historical, that we should pay attention to in 2030? Anything on policy-wise, like the code of conduct, that seems to still be out there?
It's still out there. I haven't paid a lot of attention to it because I'm not the biggest policy guy in the world, so I kind of take note of something okay, how does this affect me? kind of thing. But another big event that I can personally speak to all day is the fact that our New Space Business Plan Competition gave away a record amount of prize money, $135,000 in total prize money, actually. And it wasn't all from a NASA grant this year. We did get...
you got ATK to support you.
Our $25,000 second prize was... delivered by ATK through their sponsorship, and ATK also sponsored a $5,000 market sector award for the best entry in the area of on-orbit servicing, which was won by a startup company called Prospect Dynamics. But just very quickly, let me go over the actual winners of the competition. It was a bumpy road to get there this year because of the sequester in particular. We had to reapply for a lot of grant funding, and that, you know, it took up a lot of time. But we got our reapplication in like record time. I think we were from initial application to award in 6 weeks. I don't know who else does that.
I don't either.
Honestly, but we got it done. And then, but as a result of all those unfortunate delays, no one's fault, we felt like we had to push back the competition to October of this year instead of doing it at a New Space Conference like we usually do. We had to host it as a separate event to give us enough lead time to really promote it properly. And one of the things we did push out to the mining community a little more this year. We, you know, got after them. I don't know how much success we had in that. We had a couple entries that were mining related. Of course, we pushed out to on-orbit servicing. We had a couple entries, you know, like 7 entries in that regard for on-orbit servicing, and ATK was, you know, picked what they thought was the best one. Where's I going with this? We also had an interesting collaboration to get this thing done. As it's a really interesting experience, we actually did our event this year in late October at Stanford University. And which is kind of interesting because it was sponsored through a group of graduate students called the Stanford Student Space Initiative. So we were kind of like co-sponsors of this thing. And we held it on the Stanford campus. It was a really great event, and a lot of people attended. And we had some really great our entries this year were some of the best ever. We had 45 total entries. We got to 8 finalists. And of those, the 3 winners were the $100,000 winner is a company called Generation Orbit, and they build what they call the Go Launch air launched vehicle, horizontal air launched vehicle for small payloads with a rapid turnaround. The second place company that got the $25,000 from ATK was a company called Eligos, ELIGOS, and they build next generation electric propulsion technology that they're targeting the satellite market for orbital transfers and changing orbits and just delivery systems. And then finally, the $5,000 third place winner, again, that was sponsored by the NASA grant, was Raptor Space Services, who's developing another type of solar electric propulsion for, again, orbital transfer CubeSat.
That's Dennis Wingo, right?
That's Dennis Wingo's company, yes.
What's the purse going to be for 2014?
Oh, gosh, I wish I could tell you. We are, of course, you know, you turn right around, you start in again. This time, we're doing a different kind of, we have to reapply for the grant again this year. The RFP isn't out yet because they intend for it to be a competitive grant process. I think our group is comprising the Space Frontier Foundation and some contracted to Exodus Consulting Group. I think we still have a lead position in any kind of competitive grant process in that regard, because we do have a track record. We have, you know, a legacy and a history now of doing these things and doing them well. So I think we stand a pretty good chance in that regard. But the other thing about it is the kind of application we want to do would actually involve multiple years, which is why they had to make it competitive, because we're looking for a multi-year commitment, not just 1 year at a time. And so we'll see what happens from that. I want to have at least the same prize money we did this year, if not more. We're in discussions again. ATK has expressed at least a desire to talk about coming back again next year. I'm going to be, again, we also have had great sponsors in the past, and one of our longest sponsors is Highline Prize Trust, so we'll be talking to them again for next year, of course. They've been a great friend of this competition. We also have some private foundations that we're now going to start applying to for some major funding now that we have a track record to point to, that are very entrepreneurial in scope. And but realistically, we probably won't see anything positive out of that before, say, the 2015 season.
Are you going to be back with the New Space Conference next year?
That's the goal, yes. we've turned right around or are starting to ramp up for next year, you know, basically all in the hopes that, yeah, all these different grant funding and other types of income streams are going to all come to fruition sooner than later. If I would like to be at the New Space Conference next year.
Do you know the dates of the New Space Conference yet?
They're always late July, so it's always the last week in July.
And it's back in Silicon Valley, right?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
I haven't looked at the actual dates. It may be on the foundation website.
Okay, so now, since we're coming up to when we need to end the program, the lead-up to this year's 2013 program, because I'm going to be out of town, has been starting with your end-of-the-year reviews in 2003. You've done 10 of them. And every other year is being played on a date that I'm out of town. So starting in 2003, 5, 7, 9, you know, and on up. I know you haven't gone back and listened to them, and frankly, I haven't gone back to listen to them either. But how do you...
We're both flying blind.
We're both flying blind, well, in terms of the details, but not in terms of my question that I'm going to ask you. So if you think back over a decade, because that's the time period we're going to cover, 2003 to 2013, how do you assess the progress for new space, commercial space, opening the frontier, you know, all the things that we talk about. So we're going to document it with your shows, which you'll probably regret.
I know.
You know, since 2003 up to 2013. So just in looking back, what we remember of those years, the trials, the tribulations, the successes, how do you summarize the decade?
I would say progress obviously is real. It was a slower build-up than any of us would have liked. There's a lot of things we had high hopes for that would be developed sooner, and they just weren't. Because, you know, funding streams were hard to come by, and you're doing testing programs, and sometimes you have heroic failures, and, you know, and there's a learning curve there in the private sector, and they've all realized that, yeah. As John Carmack said, you know, when he was first starting out, he said
something we forgot for 2013.
Yeah, was that what he said once a while back, that yes, it's harder than I thought it would be, but not as hard as everyone tried to tell me it would be. And that's pretty much been the case, I think, for the development that we've seen to date over the last decade.
And he's gone into hibernation in 2013.
Pretty much.
So,
yeah.
So that's a big change.
Yeah, well, he's probably developing the next version of Doom or something. I don't know. But that's what's that. But hey, you'll laugh. That sustains him.
No, I understand.
He's happy to spend his piles of money that he makes from developing video games to fund his space hobby. I think he had the hot hand to win that centennial, that challenge.
But he didn't win it.
Maybe that took the wind out of his sails a little bit, and he's kind of reassessing, but
Mastin won it.
Yep.
So steady as she goes, but a little slower than we expected. That's kind of a one-line summary.
I hate to call it a hockey stick chart. It isn't really. I think instead of seeing a straight line progress graph over the last decade, we had seemed to be a lower progress graph, and then with a sharp up curve in the last year or two. Or some real serious successes. And sometimes that happens. You know, you invest a lot of time and money into something, and you just don't see some really great results until, you know, a long time later. We're here now, and we've got respect now, and that always leads to more funding and more development and more commercial opportunity. So it's on the map. It's not going away.
So you think that the chart for the next decade would be much more steady and much more apparent in upward trend?
The short answer is yes. The long answer is we'll have to see, as long as the current commercial developers continue to develop and continue to gain some market and they continue to fly. I think every year of that, you just get a lot more respect. And that leads to more development and more interest and more money.
Okay, so I saved the last advanced email question, which is probably going to be the hardest and nastiest for you to answer.
Okay.
For the last, okay? So this is by Ralph in Chicago.
All right.
When Tom, when you first came on the space show years ago, you touted your fund, the Colony Fund. So obviously that never went any place, and it doesn't appear from your more recent shows that you're working on that concept anymore, as you're into consulting and other things. Looking back, were you too early with the Colony Fund? Could you make it work today in 2013, 2014? What was wrong with it? Where did you stumble? Why did it not take off?
Okay. Actually, that's not a hard question at all. In fact, you already know the answer, David, because you and John Juris and Sam Dinkin and some other great people kind of helped me reach that conclusion. But to back up a step, the Colony Fund concept, I think it was a great concept. I still do. But it was a decade and a half at least ahead of its time. The markets weren't ready for it. The industry wasn't ready for it. If I had to do it different, I'd have a completely different type of proposed investment strategy. But the point really was I was developing to a certain point. I had some angel capital commitments of sufficient amount that we could, at a minimal level, you know, pull the trigger on this thing. I backed away from that brink in late 2005 after a lot of. After I spent several years in development, the moment I started going to all these conferences, I started talking to people, I started looking, really seriously looking under the hood at actual commercial development that was going on. And you know what the world was like then. It was,
The
worst signal to noise ratio of any other industry.
Yeah, in fact, you wrote that document called the signal to noise, the 13 steps, or we still use it from time to time.
Yeah. And so, I was a little bit burned out by that, and I had to sit and take a good long look and saying, the way I've got it structured, the way I plan to promote it, the market isn't ready for this, and the industry wasn't ready for this. So I put it on the shelf. Lost a couple of friends over it, but okay. At least a couple of them are starting to talk to me again. But
you would have lost more if you had pulled the trigger.
Well, are you kidding me? That would have been horrendous. So I pulled back from that disaster, but the concept is still basically sound. What I did was sit in a mountaintop for about 3 years and looked at how I would make it different if I were to do it today, and I came up with a very different type of long-term investment strategy for a fund of that nature, because it was supposed to be an exchange-traded fund on the over-the-counter market.
Right.
You can get in and out, but unlike most ETFs in an angel or venture kind of way, it would have a very different investment strategy and have a 30-year timeline instead of 10 or less. That'd be the only thing different about it. But I came up with a different investment strategy, mostly involving something we call space scalable, and I think we've discussed this before, which describes technologies that primarily are built to enhance life on Earth and make great profits for its investors here on the ground, but these specific technologies can actually be scaled to solve a space problem when the need actually comes to solve that space problem. Now we have infrastructure in place and a company ready to say, hey, here it is. We're ready. Because there are thousands of problems we need to solve in order to become a space-faring permanent species, you know, away from this planet. And launch is only one of them. So you get out of that, you know, narrow circle of endeavor a little bit, and all of a sudden all sorts of opportunities open up for you, especially in the areas of mining, nanotech, biotech, next-generation computer hardware, all sorts of things. And we've listed examples of these in the past. I'm going to be updating the Exodus Consulting website to talk about that concept even more. We've applied for a trademark application. We think that concept's so important. But yeah, if I were to do it again, it would be very different, but very much more workable. It's just a matter of timing. The irony is, when you ask that question, I've been in discussions with a fellow named Steve Jorgensen. The guy divides his time between Florida and Wisconsin. I hope he's in Florida now this time of year. but he and some other friends are trying to develop something similar. And they were like, actually, a lot of what they were working on was inspired by me. And so they, we had some discussions at ISDC and again at New Space, and they want to go forward with something similar to this, and they would like to have my involvement. So, yeah, maybe this thing is on the plate again for the next year or two. It will come back with a vengeance. Maybe the timing is right now, and the industry's right now.
It's much more ripe, that is for sure. And I think your space scalable idea has an enormous amount of merit.
Well, because it will attract an enormously wider variety of investment potential, and you don't have to be a deep pocket guy with nine figures in order to play. You can get into a space scalable investment for as low as $100,000.
You need to look at the opportunities that are emerging here for things that we can do on Earth that will have an impact in space, and vice versa. And I think you expand the investment opportunities substantially with a space scalable concept.
Mm-hmm. That's what I'm hoping. Yes.
So the Colony Fund is not dead; it's asleep. Is that a way to?
It's asleep, but it's 2.0 clone is in development right now.
2.0 clone is in development.
Yeah.
Okay.
I'm happy to say that for the record.
All right, real quick, update with Walt Anderson.
Update with Walt Anderson, okay. Since he's been back in the world, he started up a new company, and I'm working with him on it. It's called ComVergence. It offers the complete virtual computer as a service, it's called, and it'll be it's all cloud-based. The code base is being developed by a group in Indonesia, and they're about 80% done with it. We're in the middle of some major funding rounds right now, assuming we're successful with those soon. We'll be building out data centers in Singapore, Vancouver, and London. The idea of it is you have your entire virtual desktop available from the cloud, apps and all. So it's not a kludge that providers give you now. So we're actually going head-to-head with companies like Citrix and VMware and Microsoft. And develops the whole thing at once. You can be able to access this anywhere in the world with a broadband connection or close to it, and from literally any device, a desktop, a laptop, a pad, or even a smartphone. And that's where we're going now, and our beta program we hope to start in the spring or early summer next year, and that will get our first 10,000 users up and running and then wring all the bugs out. And then we'll go to the well again for another big funding round and go for total global domination like any other startup company wants to do.
Does Walt have a website?
Called comvergence.net.
C-O-M?
V-E-R-G-E-N-C-E. Comvergence.net.
.net. That's his website. And where is he headquartered? Is he in Virginia?
Yeah, it's Tysons Corner, Virginia is the official address. Yes. But my office is where my laptop is, and I'm sitting here in Salem, Oregon right now talking to you.
Okay, and when you see Walt, please give him regards and happy holidays from me.
Absolutely. I wanted to say, we're talking about Walt, a couple of things have also happened. I mean, he's also in the process. We actually acquired a small telecom in Singapore that we're either going to flip for some funding stream or just continue to use as the first data center and sales office in Singapore. So he's already acquired a company since he's been a free man again. And also, he's still a strong space advocate. He was at New Space this year.
Right, I saw him. He looks great.
Yeah, I know. He looks too much the worse for wear other than, obvious.
He looks better than me.
But he has a great attitude about life and about everything. He's not, he just wants to go forward and build the next billion-dollar company. And he's still so interested in space. He wants to jumpstart FINES again. Remember that?
Yeah, of course.
Fund for the International Non-Government Development of Space. And he wants to be able to start putting money in that again and use that for good purposes. So, he is back and he is involved and he's working hard. And I'm just grateful to go along for the ride.
It's been amazing so far, and I think we're going to do some great things.
Well, again, make sure you give him my best wishes for Christmas and New Year's, and I will send him an end-of-the-year happy note. And when he wants to come back on and the two of you want to talk about your new business, it's not directly space-related, but it is related, I'm always up for it. You know that.
Okay, yeah.
Any final 2013 closing update remarks? We ended up in a two-hour program, so what do you want to leave for our listeners?
I want to leave for your listeners, basically never give up and never surrender. That's been the lesson of 2013. A lot of guys have just been hanging in there for a long, long time. We're finally starting to see some victories, and that's just a great inspirational lesson for everyone. And I'm going to try to follow my own advice next year. So,
Okay, that's an absolutely good way to go. Never give up, never surrender.
Oh, and if y'all, Gravity is still in the theater if you want to go see it.
Great movie, except as I keep saying, somehow her hair is gravity resistant, isn't it?
And not exactly the Sally Ride look, you know, that she had
in the 80s. Or the UND gal who, God, I'm having another senior moment, who shows how to wash her hair in orbit. Who's up there right now? The blonde from the University of North Dakota. I can't believe I can't remember her name. Anyway, that's what makes things fun, right?
Absolutely.
Tom, a very Merry Christmas to you and your wife and family, and a Happy New Year to you. And I look forward to a lot of programming with you in 2014.
Same to you, David. I think it's going to be a great year coming up. And if this year's any indication, we're going to see a lot of brilliant things happening, and we're going to be excited to talk about them all next year.
And listeners, our first show of 2014 will be Sunday, January 5th. I return from New York on January 4th, and the 5th is going to be our first 2014 program. So I'll look forward to all of you joining in at that time. Goodbye, everyone, and hope you have a good, safe New Year's Eve tonight and a good holiday. May your favorite football team win, unless you support Alabama, and then may you lose to Oklahoma. Tom, take care. Have a lot of fun. Keep it safe, and we'll talk to you next year.
You too, David. Take care.
Thank you. Goodbye, listeners, from Tom and myself.